I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. It's wonderful to be with you. As we always say, it's a real privilege.
It is indeed.
And a joy.
A joy.
The subjects may not always be joyful.
They are not. But, I don't think they're ever joyful.
But it is a joy to talk to you about them.
Yeah.
And we hope you enjoy it. So how did you feel? How did you find Eddie Redmayne and the Kit Kat Club?
Well. Jesse Buckley wasn't on.
Oh.
I got the understudy. And I really only went for Jesse Buckley.
So a bit of a letdown.
So I was a bit disappointed.
Yeah.
Because it's really expensive.
Really expensive.
And I just paid that much money specifically to see her. And they don't even tell you that she's not going to be on, you know? So, like, I thought the show was amazing. And, like, yeah, Eddie did an amazing job. And, like, the production's really... And I can see why your fellow members think it's so great. But she was the thing I really wanted to see.
Yeah. That's so unfortunate.
And so it did just make it kind of disappointing.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Because you could just... I mean, the woman understudying her was good, but you could just tell she was doing, like, a version of what...
But perhaps we should explain. We're talking about Cabaret and the Kit Kat Club, which is a show in on the MC.
And Jesse Buckley as
Jesse
Sally
Buckley
Bowles.
And Jesse Buckley as Sally Bowles. Now, the criticism I've heard of Jesse Buckley is that she can sing. And the whole point about Sally Bowles is she couldn't really sing.
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty, that she's wonderful and she's got fantastic...
Yeah, she can really sing. She can really act as well.
Yeah, she's got a fantastic voice. But that's not really the point about the story.
I mean, that's fair, but I don't think that matters. I mean, yeah, I suppose they don't make that as prominent in this production. And I think if you're, like, I went with Kelly, she's never seen Cabaret before, wouldn't have any idea about...
Yeah.
You know, I don't think necessarily everybody in there was thinking about the fact she can't sing.
But that's, I mean, that came from a real pro.
That's quite specific.
Yeah. Who said, look, my problem is that in the story, she can't really sing.
Yeah.
Whereas there's no doubt at all that Jesse Buckley can sing extremely well.
Yeah.
But it's nevertheless supposed to be a great spectacle.
The couple that, like, house, the woman that runs the house and the older guy that get together and then don't get together, they were amazing. And I've seen him before in something. I meant to look him up. They were so good.
Yeah.
They just gave such heart to it.
Yes.
They were really excellent. They were my favourites.
Oh, well, that's good. I mean,
playing the lead boy, whose name I now can't remember, I didn't think was very good.
Okay.
Overall, it was a really nice evening. And also, we had seats in the dress circle. And when we got up there, they were like, oh, one of your chairs is broken. So they put us in frightfully good seats in the stalls. So that part was good.
That part was good. Yeah, that part was excellent.
I got bumped. I got upgraded.
Upgrade, yes. Mm. Oh, that's wonderful.
That part was good, but yeah.
Well, I think perhaps when this podcast comes out, the show may or may not still be running. Is it?
Well, no, it will still be running, but then they finish at the end of February.
They finish at the end of February.
Yeah.
Because I'd heard he was coming out the end of March, but it's going to be the end of February.
Oh, maybe it is March. I thought it was Feb, but it might be. It might be mid-March or something, but it's not that long.
Not much longer, yeah. We should also say that Eddie Redmayne has played the part before.
Yeah, well, I said to my friend Alistair that I was going, and Alistair went to school with him, and he was like, I've been in Eddie Redmayne's Cabaret, because Eddie Redmayne put it on at school.
Not just any school.
At Eton.
Another posh actor.
Yeah. Oh, so, yeah, really interesting. I was listening. I've been doing quite a lot of research into boarding school and, like, what it's like to go to boarding school. And I was listening to some psychologists talk about it, and they said specifically that boarding school makes very good actors because of when you go to boarding school, you're, like... You're so little, And then you have to sort of like put on a version of yourself and not show the world that you miss your mummy and daddy and all that kind of thing. And so that's why they think there's so many good
boarding school actors. You feel that about yourself? I mean, you went to boarding school.
I don't know. I'm just thinking about it. But I do think sending your child away at seven is
quite
harsh. I'm not sure about it. Yeah.
Quite harsh,
I'm not sure about it. Yeah. Or I'm just interested that I never thought about it before, but actually it is like very impactful.
Yes, it has a terrific impact. No question of that.
But beneficial and non-beneficial in lots of different.
I think it's a balance.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
It? You know,
but yeah, I think it is. It makes you very proficient in life because you're very good at being like, yep, here I am.
Yeah, I can do it.
Yeah,
leave it to me. Yes.
So yeah, that also makes you. Apparently makes for good actors, which is why you get...
Well, you've got an awful lot of Etonians now.
Posh actors.
Mm. Acting.
Tom Hiddleston, he went to Harrow, didn't
Harrow,
he?
Harrow, I think, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, enough about posh schools.
Yeah, sorry.
Very unrelatable.
Very unrelatable. Anyway, we're going to do a story this week suggested to us by William James... Now, how do I pronounce?
Limaker,
I think. I hope that's right.
We have a look.
He's apparently, Molly was telling me, he suggested quite a lot of ideas, and I thought this was a very interesting one. I would describe it as heartbreaking, actually.
Yes, and he asked as well about your opinion on... Belfield, but that's why we did.
That's why we did Belfield.
The Belfield ep.
Yeah.
The Megan Lynn Russell ep.
Yeah.
Because he was one of the many people who asked you for your opinion.
Yes.
On that. So, there you do go.
Yeah.
So what are we doing this week?
Well, it's a... The individual concerned is called Howard Hughes, and the story is called The Murder of Sophie Hook.
Murder of Sophie Hook. Okay, well, here we go.
For those of you with long memories, Sophie Hook was a 7-year-old girl who was abducted and killed in July 1995. But let's go back to the beginning. Sophie was, as I say, 7. Sophie Louise Hook had been born on the 27th of May 1988, and she lived in Cheshire. But she went to stay with her uncle, Danny Jones, in Llandudno in North Wales. They were going to celebrate one of her cousin's birthdays. Lovely day, not near the coast. I mean, London, though, is on the coast. Nice house, quite a big garden. And all the cousins came, and it was a very jolly day. And they all had a wonderful time, and they were running around the garden. And they decided that they would camp that night. Instead of going indoors to sleep in the house, their uncle's house, they'd erect a tent. And so they duly did.
How many of them? A few of them.
I think it was about 5. Mm-hmm. Might have been 6. Anyway, they planned this during the day, you know, went in conversation amongst all the young ones. And it must have been the most wonderful, in a way, the most charming, you know, innocent and happy and all of the above. And it's a lovely day and everybody's really excited and it's a lovely thought. During the day, they'd been playing in a paddling pool. You know, one of those inflatable ones that you can put up in the garden with all the cousins. And she'd, you know, taken off most of her clothes and was, you know, splashing about with all her friends. But what, and this is perhaps this is the tragedy of it, and this is what I find heartbreaking, is the houses, her uncle's house, backed onto a bridle path, you know, just sort of little path down the back of these big, quite big gardens. Mm-hmm. And
it was a terraced house.
No, they were all detached.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. The, but you know, but all, But there was no, there was not, there was Bridal Path and then there was Fields.
Okay.
So it wasn't like, that wasn't like another set of houses.
Yeah, I understand.
Unbeknown to Sophie, a local man called Howard Hughes, who'd actually been born in Llandudno, was, I'm afraid, a paedophile. And he, believe it or not, spied on these children enjoying themselves in the garden on that July day in 1995. And clearly heard them talking about, I'm going to stay, we're going to stay in the tent, in the tent, you know, that night. He had a long, we'll go back into his history in a little while, but let's just get this, this bit of the story. So he decides that he's going to abduct this little girl. But it's not just as straightforward as all that, because there are a lot of them. You know, there's a lot of little ones. I'm just trying to get my timings right here. So, earlier that same day, Howard Hughes, who was incidentally always known as Mad Howard, tried to abduct another six-year-old called Alexandra Roberts from a park a few minutes' walk away from the house where Sophia was playing. But she ran away. She ran off. So night falls. Uncle is obviously keeps an eye on the children and in the tent. And at about 12:20 a.m. on the 30th of July 1995, there were four children who had decided to sleep in the tent.
Mm-hmm.
One of them goes indoors. Decides to, she doesn't want to sleep in the tent. She wants to go and sleep in a bed. Okay. But Sophie remains. At 20 to 1, 12:40 a.m., Uncle Danny goes to check on them all. And they're all fine. Sophie's asleep between his cousin, her cousin and her sister. Her sister's staying with them again to celebrate the birthday. At 2:55 a.m. in the night time, Howard Hughes, Mad Howard, is spoken to by a police constable because he's on the seafront. He has a habit, we should say, of lurking about. I'll come back to Hughes in a minute. And at 7:15, when the cousin, Sophie's cousin, whose their birthday they'd been celebrating, wakes up. He realises she's gone. Sophie's not there. So he goes, rushes into the house and rouses all the family, and they search the garden and they go into the fields behind, and Sophie's got there. She's gone. Poof. At about 8:20 that morning, the 30th of July, they alert the police. The disappearance of Sophie Hook. By a bizarre and horrifying coincidence, at about 7:10 that morning, a man walking his two dogs along the seafront, it's a pebble beach, finds Sophie's body. It's been thrown into the sea. I'll come back to the nature of the crime in a minute. The man who found the body, he thought at first it was a pile of rags, but it clearly wasn't. He also thought it was a mannequin because she had no clothes on.
Mm-hmm.
And it profoundly changed his life. 25 years later, he gave a very moving interview about discovering the body on a beach, you know, in Llandudno, not something you would expect. And if you look at the local papers, it's very interesting at how moved he was and how traumatised, in a way, he was. The murder horrified. It's a small Welsh town It horrified the town. You can imagine how people must have reacted. But here comes the problem. And some of this is a bit painful, so please forgive me. I'll do it as gently as I can. Poor Sophie had been very brutally attacked. Her right upper arm was broken. Her right ankle was broken. She'd been persistently punched and slapped. And, of course, she'd been raped. She had terrible internal bleeding. And all those injuries were inflicted while she was alive. They were not post-mortem, anti-mortem. The poor girl had just been destroyed. I think that's the only way you can possibly describe it. And for no reason, entirely at random, and for no other reason than Hughes, his own brutal desires. Eventually, she actually was killed by being strangled, and that took about 3 minutes, according to the post-mortem. And she was dumped in the sea near a cliff at the end of the sort of promenade at Llandudno, called Little Orme. Her clothes were never found. For example, she was wearing a very distinctive pink and white Winnie the Pooh nightdress, never found. Now, there's no doubt at all that Hughes was well known to the local police. And it took them, and I'm going to come back to Hughes' story in a second, it took them literally a matter of hours before they arrested Hughes. He was well known for lurking about and bicycling about. He had a cycle. The funny thing about Hughes, though, is he came from an incredibly respectable family. He was the fourth child and the only son of a really successful civil engineer called Gerald Hughes, who ran a contracting and quarrying firm in Llandudno. You know, he was very upright indeed. But he had a chromosome abnormality, which meant that at the age of 11, he was 6 foot tall.
Wow.
And by the time he was grown into an adult, he was 6 foot eight.
That's really tall.
That's really, really tall. But then we're about to go down serial killer 101 again. He was sent to very expensive private schools by his affluent father,
mm-hmm.
none of whom could cope with him. At one point, the father offered, "I'll pay double the fees if you'll keep him." And the school said, "We can't. We just can't control him." And of course, he starts killing small animals and birds. You know, mm-hmm. absolute marker. He's just got this extraordinary temperament. You know, violent temperament. And there's no sign of it in the family at all. None. I mean, it's completely random. Now, I'm not saying this excuses any of his behaviour. It certainly doesn't. But it is no doubt that this was not nurture. So one of, again, the questions we ask each other so often is, can someone be born evil?
Mm.
Well, you might argue that this is one of those rare cases when I think you could argue.
Because he wasn't nurtured.
No, he wasn't.
Well, he was sent away from home.
Well, he was sent away. Well, eventually, at the age of 10, he was sent to a care home for the educationally subnormal children in Derbyshire. And in 1979, at the age of 14, he's transferred to another boarding school for subnormal children in Wales.
Who defines subnormal?
Oh, well, we are talking about 1978.
Just so much that I'm comfortable.
Yes.
That.
Well, I accept that. I'm not. His father, when he left school, without any qualifications, gave him a job. He owned a successful firm.
His father probably felt guilty for not really parenting him.
Perhaps, but the trouble was that Howard, the son, acted like he owned the place. He was sort of the boss's son. I don't have to do anything. I'm just here. And that did not endear him to any of his fellow workers, as you might imagine. But by 1981, at the age of 16, he was born in 1965, I'm afraid the first signs of the paedophilia came out. He took a seven-year-old boy to a derelict house and exposed himself to him and started to strangle him. The boy, to his eternal credit, played dead, and Howard Hughes left. He was convicted, of course, because the boy could identify him. And he was a local anyway. He was, known. And he was given a 2-year mental health supervision order. And he was sectioned under the Mental Health Act 1959. He clearly was disturbed. Mm. And there can be no doubt about it. But on his release from the sectioning and the mental health order, he went to live with his mother, Renee, who at this point had broken up with his father, Gerald. And they went to live in Colwyn Bay, also in North Wales, not very far away. It's not as though he was moving, across the country. Mm. He was literally just moving down the coast. But by the age of 19, by now he's 6'8", he had 17 convictions of crimes of all kinds, including burglary, theft, assault, possession of weapons. He had a passion for guns and knives. And he had 2 custodial sentences before he reached his 30th birthday in 1995. He'd been accused of assaulting young girls aged 3, 5, and 9 in the years between his release and 1995. But none of the parents wanted to bring a case against Hughes because they didn't want to put their children through any more of an ordeal, as they would have to have done, to relive what happened to them.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying that they were wrong. And one can understand the answer, what must have been in their mind. But what I'm saying is, here you have a man who is programmed, I would say, to be a paedophile. And is exhibiting it consistently. And yet there's no mechanism, or there doesn't seem to be, to stop him doing it. Howard Hughes, Mad Howard, is arrested at 10 to 4 in the afternoon of the morning in which Sophie's body is found. He's held for 4 days, but there's no forensic evidence whatever.
At all?
None.
I suppose the body was in the sea.
Yes, the body's in the sea.
What?
Mm. There's no forensic. Mind you, we are talking about 1995, and the slightly forensics hadn't moved as far as they have now. But in the wake of his arrest, 3 vital witnesses come forward. So on the 3rd of August, the Crown Prosecution Service decide they haven't got enough evidence to charge him, and temporarily, for a matter of hours, release him. But he's very rapidly rearrested as soon as the witnesses have given formal statements to the police. And the witnesses were 3. His father, Gerald, who said, who'd rushed to see him when he was locked up in Rill, near Colwyn Bay, and said that he'd confessed. Mad Howard denied it later, but his father was absolutely clear that he'd confessed to him. Then another man, a career criminal called Jonathan Carroll, said he'd seen him. Carol was a burglar, and he'd seen him during the night of the 30th of July in the dark. He was burglaring a house nearby and had seen, and I don't mean to laugh, but he'd seen Mad Howard carrying a sack, big Hessian sack.
Okay.
And a third man, a self-confessed sex offender, who said that Hughes had boasted about wanting to rape and assault a young girl. And all those three witnesses appeared at Chester Crown Court in 1996, a year later, a year after the disappearance and the murder, to give evidence against Howard Hughes. The jury, it took them absolutely no time at all to find him guilty of abduction, rape and murder. And he was given three life sentences. And the judge memorably called him, Mr. Justice Richard Curtis, said, and I quote, "You are a fiend. Your crime is every parent's worst nightmare come to pass. No girl is or ever will be safe from you." And he recommended, it wasn't then possible, he recommended that he should never be released. In fact, in 2002, the then Home Secretary, David Blunkett, gave him a minimum sentence of 50 years. Hughes has appealed in 1997 and 2001. But when he was given the 50-year minimum, he never challenged, he never appealed it. And so you have to expect that Hughes is very almost certain to spend the rest of his life in jail. He certainly deserves to be described as one of the world's most evil killers. Mm. There can be no doubt about it.
Yeah.
It was premeditated, planned, executed, and then a most brutal attack on the poor innocent girl who, if you look at the picture of her, if you look up Sophie Hook on Wikipedia, she's just got this little smiley, charming little smiley face. It is, I agree with the judge here. It is a fiendish crime.
Yeah, agreed.
All she was sleeping in a tent in her uncle's garden on a warm July night in 1995 when a man, whom she didn't know, decides to abduct her and then brutally assault her and eventually strangle her. I think it is every parent's worst nightmare.
It 100% is.
You know? And I'm very grateful to William for reminding me about the case, because to be honest, I'd forgotten about it. But there is no doubt in my mind that if anybody richly deserves a 50-year sentence, it's Howard Hughes.
Yeah, agreed. Awful.
I'm afraid it is. But I think what I find fascinating about the case is this is one of those ones when I actually do believe, or you can at least make a very strong case,
that he was born evil.
Born evil. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, that it was so clear, so blatantly obvious from a really early age.
Unless it's not that I'm trying to make excuses for him, because I'm not.
No.
But if his chromosomal abnormality had more impact, or there was like further impact on him that you might not know about.
You could argue.
And then if that had caused him to be bullied, or I'm not saying but these things can, or like have a different opinion of himself or how he had to put himself out in
yes.
the world.
Yes, but the chromosome abnormality is obviously important.
Mm.
But there's also no doubt that there was nothing, and I'm being entirely fair to his mum and dad here, there was nothing in the upbringing that was anything but affectionate, warm.
But if you send him away...
I don't think they knew what to do with him.
But if you do that, that isn't upbringing.
No.
Because you're passing the upbringing to to institutions.
Yes. So just to go back to what we started this conversation.
Appropriate that I raised it earlier.
Yes. Don't you think that's amazing? Mm. Often these conversations do have a sort of circular nature.
Yeah.
Yeah, you come back to it. Mm. You know, had he been kept at home?
Would it have made a difference?
Would it have made a difference?
Potentially.
You think it would?
No, I'm not saying it would. I'm not saying he wasn't evil, but I don't think we know enough about the actual circumstances, but I don't think I agree with you. Do I agree with you?
No,
I see what you mean by saying, like, born evil, yes, because he was raised out of the familial home. But that in itself is being raised, but just in a different way.
In a different way, yes.
And that can be impactful.
Yes.
Or as impactful, potentially, as being raised in a very difficult home.
Yes.
For certain people.
But having a very violent
upbringing. Depend on your personality. Yeah. But if you're told to look after yourself from a very young age, that can lead you to behave in certain ways.
Yes.
Also. So, yeah, it is being raised in a way.
That's it. That's that point. Is where is the connection?
But it's not being raised in a familial home.
No, not in a domestic environment that you can recognise.
Yeah.
Yes.
And not with a primary or two primary caregivers.
No.
Which is, I would say, the distinction.
Yes. Hmm. Yeah, I think it's I really do think it's a very, very interesting point.
Yeah.
And I think what makes it more interesting for me is, you know, you could predict it. I mean, there were three opportunities.
Yeah, that is, yeah. I do find these ones the hardest when you know then there's somebody who really is likely to
do something terrible.
Do something bad. And then so many, you know, obviously poor Sophie, but Sophie's family and the man who found her and all of these people suffer for the rest of their lives.
Yes. And the impact, as we've talked to each other so many times, the impact on the family is, I mean, the uncle felt guilty because he hadn't protected them properly.
It's dreadful.
The parents, of course, who'd sent her away with her sister to go and stay and have a jolly time, and they felt guilty.
No, it's the worst thing that can happen.
It
and
is.
It's not anybody's fault. It's just, you know, that's why be careful.
But you blame yourself.
Oh, of course, because what else would you do?
You've got to. There's no real choice. But goodness me, I mean, it's a horrific crime. Despicable. There's no possible excuse. It was an act of grotesque violence. And what's worse, it was premeditated. And the question that we've often asked, aren't we, you know, why? Why indeed?
Mm.
I haven't got an answer for that. I really wish I had, but I don't. But what I can say is, for me, it feels a bit like the bad seed argument, you know. And I'm not putting any blame on the parents at all. I'm not saying, oh, you raised him badly or anything.
No, in fact, you're saying the opposite of that.
Yeah, but I do accept your point. I think it's a well-made one that perhaps if he'd stayed, been kept at home, perhaps if he'd been...
I think when there's... So I can imagine that's when you've got someone, a child or a situation, and you don't know how to handle it. And at that time, there's probably much less support. Probably what he needed was like more psychological care, and the parents needed more support as to how to care for him.
How to get it, yes.
Yeah. You would think to yourself, like, I don't know how to do it, so I'm going to send him somewhere who does know how to do it. But, I'm very uneasy as to whether that is actually a solution or it's an
adult. Is that the right answer?
No. Yeah, because what you're saying to your child at that point is like, you're too difficult. I don't want it. You're too difficult. You're too much for me.
Well, but remember, he's got three elder sisters, all of whom presumably are
terribly well-behaved.
Well-behaved. And he grows up to be this enormous child, 11.
Yeah,
he's 6 foot 11.
You don't fit. And then your parents are like, do you know what? We don't, it's too much. We're sending you away. We don't want you in our family. You don't fit. So you're immediately telling a child, Yeah. You don't belong here. You don't. You're not right. You don't fit in. Yeah. So you're imprinting that on someone very young. So that's not necessarily born evil. But if you're told you look weird, you're different to everyone else, we don't want you in our family. Mm-hmm. You need to go and live with subnormal, which is very unhappy about that.
Well, that just adds to it. If I'm right and you're right, which we both might be.
Yeah.
I think if you're born with an abnormality.
Yeah.
And you're then on top of it is added other things.
Of course, then your predilection potentially is going to be want to lash out, cause trouble, you know, all these sorts of things. Inflict pain, and pain was inflicted on you. No one cared about you. You don't fit in. Why should anyone else?
Also, I think that one of the things I find very interesting about this particular pathology, the psychopathology of Hughes, is he had three elder sisters. Was there something in there?
Yeah, he's probably wanted to inflict pain on girls the sisters because they had a great time being raised and they were welcome in his family and he wasn't.
He wasn't, no. But I'm not excusing, not for one second.
No, me neither.
It's a despicable crime. But it does raise a couple of very interesting issues.
Agreed.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Thank you. Thanks,
pleasure.
William, for suggesting it.
Thank you for suggesting it.
Even though it was really horrible.
Yes.
Don't forget to remind everyone about our quiz on Patreon.
Yes, Patreon.
It should be up by now. By the time you're listening to this, it should be up.
Yes, good.
So please get on there.
Have a look.
So do join our Patreon to see our quiz, and there'll be some prizes at the end of the month.
Yes.
They'll probably be pretty great.
Great prizes, I promise.
True crime prizes.
I've got one of them coming. It's a quite a famous poisoner, 1920s poisoner.
Nice.
Solicitor.
Okay.
Hmm.
Cool.
Quite a famous case.
That's a good one.
Hmm.
Have we got any?
I'm going to talk about the case, but I thought we might also use it as one of the prizes.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah.
You say you've got it coming, do you mean a book?
It's a book.
A book.
It's a book. Yes, because it's. I think it's the 100th anniversary.
Okay.
And the poisoning inspired Dorothy L. Sayers and Agatha Christie. It was very public poisoning. And
very
he was
good.
Hanged.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Yes. So that's one of the prizes.
Excellent.
There will be others. And we're going to make a little habit of it.
There'll be a washing machine, a cuddly toy.
Yes.
An ironing board.
Yep.
I tried to make Dad go on the generation game with me so many times.
Yes. This is an entirely random piece of information.
I don't know if any of you remember the generation game, but I loved Bruce Forsyth.
Yes.
And I loved the generation game. And the premise of it, for those of you who don't know, was that it was like a Saturday. It was like Saturday, what you watch now, Ant and Dec, Saturday Live Takeaway or whatever.
Yeah.
It was like that Saturday night version of that. And the premise was that two people who were related went on and competed against two other people who were related in a sort of series of very pathetic games.
Yeah, it's like making pottery.
Yeah, exactly. You have to do tasks. And then at the end, if you won, there was a conveyor belt of gifts that went past. You had to watch them, and then everyone you remembered you could take home with you.
That's right.
And there was always a cuddly toy.
Always a cuddly toy.
But the premise obviously was that you had to be related, so obviously I thought me and Dad going on it would be perfect, but he was adamant that was not something I could even apply for.
Oh, you wrote to all manner of people.
I did, but I never wrote to Generation Game.
Oh. Well, I'm sorry I let you down.
No, it's fine. It's fair enough. I understand now why you wouldn't have wanted to do it, but my 8-year-old self...
Your 8-year-old self is rather different.
Did not understand.
Anyway, darling, thank you. Thank you
for that information.
That was The Murder of Sophie Hook.
Thanks, Dad. Thank you to all the people that help us, our producer Sam Brain, my brother Dan who did the music, my friend George who do our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Jeffrey for all the hard work, and to you, the listeners. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. And thank you, Molly, for all your solicitors looking after this wonderful podcast and making it all happen. Because without you, it would not be possible. So thank you, too. And as I often say, please be careful out there.